Hi everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. Today we have another great research scientist from CNA Corporation, and we are going to be talking about a new paper titled Drone Strikes in Pakistan, Reasons to Assess Civilian Casualties. And our research scientist of the day from CNA Corporation is Dr. Larry Lewis, and I'm very happy to have him on the show. So let me just thank you for coming on the show, Dr. Lewis.
Happy to be here.
And just for our listeners, CNA Corporation is a nonprofit research and analysis organization, and it's located in Alexandria, Virginia. And it serves the public interest by providing in-depth research and solution-oriented analysis to help decision makers choose the best course of action in setting policy and managing operations. And also, just so you know, CNA is not an acronym and is correctly referred to as CNA Corporation. So I also highly recommend our listeners to go to the website and look at other great research and analysis that CNA provides. And let's start talking about this paper on drone strikes in Pakistan. So what I'll do is I'll hand over the table to you, Dr. Lewis, and ask you to give us a brief outline of what the paper discusses.
Certainly. So CNA has been deeply involved in support to the military in Afghanistan, both ISAF and to U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan, looking at the issue of civilian casualties. And so, true to what you just described, the CNA provides in-depth research and solution-oriented analyses to help decision makers in policy. We then did this study called Drone Strikes in Pakistan, looking at similar issues in Pakistan and extrapolating the lessons and the analytical approach we used in Afghanistan to look at the drone campaign in Pakistan, and particular on the issue of civilian casualties, which has been a contentious issue in their use in Pakistan.
And so why don't we first talk a little bit about the debate surrounding drones, because it's a very hot topic. You hear a lot of things on social media and in the news. So could you maybe outline a little bit of the debate surrounding drones before we actually start talking about drone strikes in Pakistan?
Absolutely, and you're right. There are a number of different debates. The first is ethical considerations of the use of drones. For example, there's a discussion about the effect of the increased distance between the target and the person pulling the trigger or making the decision regarding the use of force. So this is targeted killings at a distance. For example, in the press just the last week or so, there was a group called Not a Bug Splat. That's their name. And they made a 60 by 90 foot poster of a child killed by a drone strike in Pakistan, and they put it in a highly targeted region of Pakistan, and their aim was to try and humanize drone attacks and their victims. So, and that's just one example of people that are trying to address this ethical consideration of the use of force through more remote platforms that drones have. Another one, there's a debate on legal considerations, the legal basis for the use of force in areas outside of declared areas of armed conflict, such as Pakistan and Yemen. There's also debate about the employment of drones and the use of force by different organizations within the U.S. government, and whether they comply with international humanitarian law, for example, the Geneva Conventions. And then finally, the concerns about civilian casualties, as well as tactics that may cause civilian casualty to be more likely with drone use. For example, there's been a discussion about signature strikes and the double tapping of targets during strikes.
And I mean, this is what the brunt of your paper is on, the reasons to assess the civilian casualties. And I mean, drones are highly used in counterterrorism operations, especially in Afghanistan and the Pakistan region. So let's look at this, because in your paper, you mentioned that the U.S. the U.S. government describes its drone campaign in Pakistan and elsewhere as causing minimal civilian casualties. However, your available open source data that you used in this research shows that drone strikes in Pakistan, as well as data on air operations in Afghanistan, including drone operations, points to higher numbers of casualties than suggested in official statements. So it seems, after reading through this paper, that there's a very big discrepancy on U.S. casualty rates declared versus independent research done by independent non-government organizations and their numbers. So let's look at this a bit.
Okay, so yes, so that's a definitely the paper points out that there's a big discrepancy, and of course we don't have the operational data from the drone strikes in Pakistan, so I have to say that up front. So we're trying to piece together a picture with the available data, and so I did that with the data sources that were out there in the open source, as well as trying to extrapolate operational data from Afghanistan, from military operations. So we kind of came at it from two different angles and tried to come up with a validation process using those two sources. But you're right, and actually I liken this to the situation we were in Afghanistan in the 2007, 8, 9 timeframe, where the U.S. military was saying we caused very few civilian casualties, but then in the open press, the ICRC, which is the Red Cross, and other organizations, even UN in Afghanistan, was saying, hey, we see a lot of civilian casualties. And it took a process to kind of cross level, and the military finally realized, you know, we are causing more than we had realized. But it took a process to make that recognition.
And then you also mention in the paper the other parties involved in estimating civilian impact of drone strikes. And you talk about the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, New American Foundation, and UN Special Reports. Could you maybe give us a brief overview of these organizations, or independent non-government organizations, we could call them?
Certainly. So the U.S. doesn't give out official numbers of civilian casualties from these operations. So, you know, they've kind of given general descriptions that they're surgical. They cause very little. At some points, they've even said, you know, for time periods there are no civilian casualties. So, in the absence of, I guess, transparency, several organizations like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and the New America Foundation have tried to leverage news reporting and for BIJ, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, they've also tried to leverage some other information sources to try to piece together what is happening and then present it to the public to increase transparency about these strikes. So both of them have a common methodology. They will look at media reporting for specific reported strikes and try to piece together what appears to be a consensus in what happened. And often there can be a range. So for example, for a particular strike on a particular day, one newspaper may say one civilian was killed, another one may say three civilians was killed. So that produces a range of civilian casualties from for each of these reports. So basically, I got the data from these different organizations and analyzed it. Now, another source is the UN. There was a UN report looking at civilian casualties in Pakistan, and they actually have another number in their report, and I need to be clear that the number they have was not based on data that they acquired, but it was talking to the government of Pakistan. So in that case, the UN was a pass-through for the Pakistani government reporting a number.
And with the Pakistani government reporting a number, how honest do you think that number would be? I mean, can we take it as face value, or could there be embellishment on it, or vice versa?
That's a great question, and it is tough to say. And in fact, their numbers have kind of moved up and down depending on the political climate, which in itself illustrates how this is a very political issue. And so, and it, this is perhaps why the U.S. has been reluctant to share numbers, because it is very political. So, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily believe that number in itself. That's why I included it as one of several sources and kind of put them alongside each other. And when you do that, you start to see there is kind of a common ground from those different sources.
And then going back to these organizations, you were talking about the similarities as they're using the data from newspaper articles for gathering numbers of civilian casualties. Are there any differences between the organizations and how they get this data? I mean, are there other ways that they get it other than just the newspaper reports? Are there any
Sure.
feet on the ground, so to speak?
Yes. So the New America Foundation, NAF, they really just use news reporting. And so there have been some comments or even criticism of them that they will tend to have a bias towards underreporting civilian casualties. Actually, NAF also does something else. They have several categories of the casualties. They have the militant, which are basically the fighters or people associated with Al-Qaeda. They have confirmed civilian, and they also have a third category called other or unknown, where we don't know who those are. Now, one of the issues is that NAF, when they publish civilian casualties, they just report the confirmed civilian, but actually with under international humanitarian law, the way we're supposed to be counting both before and after the use of force is if they're unknown, they're supposed to be considered civilian unless you have evidence to provide otherwise. So actually, New America Foundation and organizations that use that data, which are many, including CNN often uses them as a report, they are systematically underreporting these numbers based on that source. So that's New America Foundation. Bureau of Investigative Journalism, they don't do that. They basically have they kind of follow humanitarian law in their accounting, and they also rely on other reports. So they've gone to Pakistan and done some on-the-ground reporting. They've looked at some lawsuits that kind of shed some light on the casualty status. They even use they use WikiLeaks to get some information. We in the government can't do that, but some people do that. So there are some differences in their organizations.
So, going back to numbers, why don't we talk a little bit about these discrepancies on a number scale?
Certainly. So when I got the data from the different organizations and kind of put them side by side, first of all, New America Foundation, they systematically underreported because they didn't treat the unknown category consistently. So I adjusted for that. And when you adjust for that, you get ranges, kind of a minimum to a maximum range. And so actually the minimum for all these sources is pretty similar. UN was about 400. Bureau of Investigative Journalism was a little over 400. New America Foundation was about 450. So actually they're surprisingly similar. And then the upper range varied more. I think UN was like 600. Bureau of Investigative Journalism was around 950, and NAF was a little over 800. So a fairly large range, But the lower range did seem to be about 400. And I don't want to be too dogmatic about the specific numbers. These are just general estimates. I think the most important point is that these estimates are consistently much greater than you would imagine from some of the public comments that the U.S. official comments that have been made about the ranges of civilian casualties.
And for our listeners who haven't read the report yet, what time frame do these numbers take place in?
Yes, so these for Pakistan, they started around 2004, but really they're at a pretty low level through 2007, and then they increased significantly in 2008, kind of peaked in 2010. I think in 2010, a little over 120 strikes in that year, and then they've been going down ever since. So 2013, we actually had just over 20, about two dozen strikes.
Right. So, going to these strikes and the discrepancies, why don't we look at the possible reasons between U.S. statements and data findings? So I know you list a number of topics that you touch on and elaborate on in the paper, such as casualties from airstrikes for civilian casualties from airstrikes are hard to recognize when they occur, the idea of an irregular enemy, misidentification, battle damage assessment based on air surveillances, and you have a couple of other ones. So why don't you give our listeners a brief overview of these topics? So why don't we start with civilian casualties being hard to recognize?
Certainly. So, and this is based on what we saw in Afghanistan. So we're kind of in the same situation where, for years we had official U.S. statements saying we caused no civilian casualties, and then people brought, the dead bodies to the base, or they were caught on BBC or something else. So we had this experience over and over where we said there were no casualties, but then it turned out in the end that there were. And so I basically looked at, analyzed the reasons why this happened, and it went into several categories. One is the fact that they are an irregular enemy. So, the U.S. military trains for an adversary to be, wearing uniforms, driving distinctive vehicles, using different weapon systems that are easily identifiable. And so the positive identification process, U.S., we're supposed to positively identify the enemy. And it's made very easy when they have signatures, characteristics that we can identify. They really don't have that. So just overall, it's a tougher process that we have to deal with. So, compounding with that, you have the process of misidentifications. So there are a number of cases where the U.S. believes that someone is an enemy combatant, but it turns out they're not. So we discover later, or sometimes we just don't discover, in fact, that they were. And there are a couple reasons for that. First of all, we can misinterpret their actions, or we can misinterpret their characteristics. There are a number of Afghan civilians that we ended up killing because we believe they were emplacing IEDs, improvised explosive devices, in the road. But after the fact, after we engaged them, we found they were digging drainage ditches, or they were doing some other agricultural work. Other times, someone would see a fighter, and so enemy fighter, and so they engaged them. Turned out it was actually a farmer carrying a shovel over his shoulder. So there are a number of things where we think it's a sign of nefarious activity, but actually it's not. So that's another reason. The other thing is guilt by association. Sometimes you will truly have enemy forces, but then there are civilians in close proximity who were not participating in hostilities, but they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And when we engage them, That's not easy to tell. So sometimes we assume that they're enemy because they're in the wrong place, and only later do we discover that we made that error, which is of course regrettable. So, and compounding those difficulties is a third thing for drone strikes, and for air strikes in general, is that after we strike, we do a process called battle damage assessment. So, and that is basically looking at the effect of the engagement on the enemy and the surroundings. So, we in the military we call it a BDA, so battle damage assessment. From the air, these can be very difficult to do in practice. So, and you can think about kind of from simplest case to hardest case. So simplest case, there is a person walking across a field, you do an airstrike, there's nothing around, so you can pretty much tell, okay, I had the effect I wanted on the individual, nothing else was affected. Toughest case is you do an airstrike on a building. So you strike the building, maybe you can watch people come in and out of the building. You do something called pattern of life, so you try to understand people coming in and out over time, so you try to characterize who's in the building, but ultimately you can't see in the building. Maybe there's a hole you can see in a part of the building, but you just don't know for sure. And so we've seen a number of cases where there have been people buried under the rubble that the aircraft just doesn't know that they're there until people, the general population come in later and start digging through the rubble and find people that we just did not know were there. So those are the chief reasons why the U.S. can tend to underestimate civilian casualties from these operations.
So looking at these operations a bit, I just have a question that's on my mind of how you describe looking at, say, a compound or an area where you think there's some sort of activity going on. How long, is there a time period that's a general time period that they sort of do this pre-evaluation of a potential strike target? Or does it really depend on the situation?
Yes, it does depend on the situation. I mean, and obviously the longer you can do the pattern of life, the longer you can stare at a target before you strike it, the better your chances are of understanding who's in there. But there have been cases where targets have been stared at for a long time. I'll just say that, a long time. And then it turns out that there are women and children inside the compound that never left.
Mm-hmm.
In that culture, it's different than probably in America, but in that culture, the women and children don't necessarily leave the house a lot. So it can be harder to characterize who's there.
Very much so. So expanding on this point, you sometimes in articles and different talks on drones, you get these terms of, and I think you mentioned them earlier in the talk, the terms surgical and humane, which are described to, I mean, they're used to describe drone precision. But on the other hand, there's this counter side to it that you just mentioned. So let's look at these two terms, surgical and humane, and I'd like to hear your theory on that in regards to these drone strikes.
Certainly. There does seem to be a propensity of some to almost make drones magical, that somehow by using this platform, we're going to avoid the issue of civilian casualties, and it's just not so. There's one quote in the press that said, where civilian casualties cannot be avoided, they must be minimized, which is a great point. But then they say, this is what drone strikes do. But in fact, that's not what drone strikes do. Drones are just a platform. And so what you really need if you want to minimize civilian casualties, it's more than the platform, it's the process. So you have other factors that are very important if you want to minimize civilian casualties. So you have to consider planning, You have to consider training. You have to consider, you know, the pattern of life, the kinds of intelligence. There's a whole process that has to go into this. So this kind of assumption that drones are more surgical than other things is not true from a theory point. And we've actually done analysis on this too. So again, in Afghanistan, we looked at operational data and found that in fact, if you compare drone strikes versus manned airstrikes, that drone strikes were 10 times more likely to cause civilian casualties than were manned airstrikes. So again, there's a misunderstanding that drones are somehow special and not going to cause civilian casualties. There are some great advantages of drone platforms. They're very persistent. You can put some very capable intelligence capabilities on drones. They have, you know, they have the Hellfire missile, which is a low collateral damage weapon. Definitely, they're a good platform, but there's nothing special about them, absent the larger process.
So another thing you mentioned in the paper is you use examples of airstrikes, and I'd kind of like to look at those a bit. You talk about, and I hope I pronounce this right, the Debala airstrike and the Farha airstrike. So I was wondering if we could discuss these a bit and the findings that you gathered from these examples.
Certainly. So yes, I just chose to, and in the work that CNA did for ISAF, we actually looked at hundreds of these incidents. And I'll probably talk about this later, but one of the important things we did is not just looking at individual incidents, because what you find is when these campaigns are being done, there's always an investigation. And so we may find issues with an individual incident. Mm-hmm. However, the real benefit that we provided was we didn't just stick to looking at one incident. We looked across the board at a whole lot of incidents and looked at the forest instead of individual trees. And you find patterns start to emerge that you just don't notice if you're looking at an individual incident. Having said that, I can talk about a few of these and then kind of bring out some of the things that tend to happen in the larger set of incidents. So the first was Debala. So this is back in 2008, and it was a special operations operation where they were targeting a senior leader of an enemy network, and so they were targeting an airstrike. Unfortunately, this is one of those cases where civilians happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and so they ended up engaging this group of civilians instead of the enemy combatant. And unfortunately, you read lots of wedding strikes. This is one of those wedding strikes. Mm-hmm. So these local people were going from one village to another village. It was a wedding party, and they were coming through this kind of mountainous area, and they went into this area that was going to be targeted, and so they were misinterpreted as enemy combatants, and there were airstrikes. So soon thereafter, the local population and also the BBC in this case claimed high levels of civilian casualties, and the initial response from the U.S. military was denial. And in fact, they said, we don't believe we've harmed anyone except for the combatants. And they also pointed to military extremists being behind the accusations of civilian casualties. So, but later on, they did an official investigation, brought in additional evidence, and found that in fact dozens of civilians were killed from the airstrike. So what? There are a number of factors that led to this, but one of the points I wanted to bring out is, the U.S. spokesman truly believed that there were no combatants. that, no, sorry, no civilians that were killed. It wasn't a cover-up. They truly believed it based on the information that they were provided. However, because of the factors we discussed a little bit earlier, they didn't recognize that they were actually civilians killed. Another incident in Farah in 2009, this is in the Bala Baluch area of Farah province in Afghanistan. There was a large group of Taliban moved into the area. Afghan forces went out to encounter them. They were ambushed and overpowered. So there were some U.S. Marine special forces in the area. They came out to basically rescue the Afghans. So they used airstrikes to counter the enemy. First, very very close to the line of battle, and then as the enemy combatants retreated, a number of airstrikes in the village where they retreated. Unfortunately, the airstrikes in the village killed dozens of civilians. And again, you saw reports of civilian casualties in the media and in the government and other organizations. However, ISAF again said, you know, we don't believe there were any civilian casualties. And a number of denials for over a week until the investigation team came in and said, you know what, there actually were a number of civilian casualties. So those two examples show both how we can have misidentification and inaccurate or lacking battle damage estimate, and how we can come out very strongly and deny civilian casualties that occurred, but in fact, because we had a presence on the ground and we had relationships with organizations on the ground, we were able to find out that we were mistaken and there was in fact civilian harm.
I found something interesting in this study. You found that drone strikes in Pakistan were more likely to cause civilian casualties on average than drone strikes in Afghanistan. And I was wondering why this is, and also what are the factors involved?
That is an excellent question. And in fact, I would love to know that too. based on the work the CNA did for ISAF in Afghanistan, we had access to all of their data. So we had access to the records, we had access to the investigations, we did detailed root cause analysis. We could tell you exactly what was happening and the root factors behind civilian casualties for all different kinds of operations. And we looked at rates and looked at trends, so we could tell you even why trends were going down. We don't have that level of fidelity for this data. So the chief recommendation of this report is to do for counterterrorism operations in Pakistan and for Yemen too, honestly, do that same process that we did in Afghanistan.
Then another thing that you mentioned further on in the paper, which I think is a good thing to sort of bring this conversation to, is the process of responding to drone strikes. And you mentioned some ideas of setting up a special process that would help I don't know if you'd say reduce civilian casualties, but deal with the aftermath, such as, let's see, you mentioned like creating a response team and so forth. I mean, that's a great idea, but on other terms, in some of these areas that could be quite hostile depending on the environment, I mean, how realistic would that be for the U.S. to actually set up responses to go to sites and so forth after a strike?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So, you know, first of all, why would we do this?
Right.
Why would we have the idea that after we do a strike and we cause civilian casualties, why should the U.S. feel obligated to do anything about it?
To me, when I read that, it was almost like a diplomatic form of damage control, so to speak.
Sure. Sure. So first of all, there's no legal requirement for the U.S. to do anything. So that's an important caveat. At the same time, it's good to recognize the impact that this has on the U.S. So we see over and over that drone strikes and civilian casualties from drone strikes fuel terrorist propaganda, right? So I mean, we've seen that over and over. There have been a number of studies. There are a bunch of interviews, field work done that show that in the local areas where we're doing drone strikes, I mean, I want to be balanced. There are some who welcome the drone strikes because they recognize that there are bad people in their area and they welcome someone doing something about it. So, I mean, that's important to say. At the same time, we also see in local areas, drone strikes, and especially the civilian casualties from drone strikes, can turn people away from the U.S. and towards terrorist groups. Partially, it's the revenge factor. In Afghanistan, you have Pashtunwali, so there's a revenge culture. But you see that in Pakistan, you see that in Yemen. Another reason this can happen, you can have radicalization, is because Al-Qaeda and associated groups turn these strikes and the casualties to their advantage. So there are a number of cases where we'll do a strike, we'll cause civilian casualties, then Al-Qaeda will come into the area and say, "We are so sorry. We sympathize with you. We're going to pay for your funeral. We're going to take care of you." And so that produces support on the ground, support for these groups. So you know, Al-Qaeda fills this void. Now in Afghanistan, the U.S. found that there was operational advantages to filling that void and not letting the enemy fill it. So we found for when we caused civilian casualties, we'd have a process called a consequence management process, where we would go in, we'd investigate, but we'd also do two components that were very important. We would apologize because it was unintentional, and we would also provide amends. And that could be financial. It could be some other kind of way to just to show a token of U.S. sincerity. And we saw cases where a whole community that was really not very sympathetic to the U.S., when they saw the U.S. response to civilian casualties in their area, they actually turned towards the U.S. in a way that they hadn't before. So there are operational advantages to this. And I will say the U.S. already has programs in place to provide amends, provide financial assistance to war victims in conflict zones. So it's not like we need to invent a program. But basically, it's just a policy decision to say we will include victims from our own operations in that program. Now, as you point out, it may be difficult for the U.S. to do that in areas where we deny operations. However, even in Afghanistan, we had a number of cases where we found it was more expedient to use the host nation as a pass-through. So we would provide the resources to the government. The government then goes and provides it to the victim, and everybody wins because now you're actually showing, you're enabling the host nation government to provide essential services and care for the population, which they should be doing anyway. And it gives legitimacy to the government and helps alleviate some of the negative effects from civilian casualties from our own operations.
And how willing have these host governments been? And of course, in this case, it would be Pakistan and Afghanistan. And also, you hear lots of stories of Afghanistan, the government and industries there being highly corrupt. I mean, how does this work in such an environment?
Sure. Well, in Pakistan and in Yemen, they're actually, in both cases, the government has provided compensation to victims in cases that become public. So the difference is, you know, we're not necessarily counting civilian casualties very well, and so we only find out about them when others bring it to our attention. So in those cases, the the governments generally have provided compensation. So it's not necessarily getting them to do something that they haven't been willing to do, because they've demonstrated they're willing and able to do it. But it's a matter of tying, first of all, improving our assessment process, which we need to do for the reasons we talked about before, but then informing the host nation government and perhaps using, really, we're talking paltry funds, but providing that to the host nation government so they can follow through more consistently.
And to kind of wrap up the conversation, you were saying that we need to improve assessing these civilian casualties. What are the best ways to improve this?
Sure. So one thing that we definitely do in the military, and I assume we do in strikes in Pakistan by other government agencies, is I assume there's an assessment process that is done after incidents that where there are accusations of civilian casualties. Now, how well that's done, are there additional information that can be considered? I found we're not always, the government is not always the best in considering kind of non-standard sources. So if you have something in a newspaper, if you have something from the UN, if you have something from ICRC, the Red Cross, those don't necessarily have to be definitive, but we can use those things to cue us to look for other things. So we may get information from some agency, some organization, and we may use that to look for human or other kinds of intelligence that might help confirm or at least strengthen the position that we're getting from another organization. So that's kind of at the independent incident level. So I think we can strengthen that. We can also strengthen the process by looking at these incidents more systematically. So instead of just looking at each incident independently, we can look for trends across the board and look more systematically. And that's something that we generally just haven't done. And again, I haven't seen the data for Pakistan, so I mean, it is possible they're doing this, but just based on the different communities that I work with, I have not seen that process done in the communities that I work with.
Very interesting. Well, we like to give our guests an opportunity to maybe touch upon something that we might not have touched upon that you find important, or if there's something else that you'd like to bring up that's on your mind, I would like to sort of hand over the table before we conclude this talk and give you that platform.
Okay, so this is the first paper of actually a series of papers on drone strikes that we're doing. So you can anticipate some additional releases by CNA in the coming months, and we tend to explore some of these issues as well as some other issues. So the next paper I'm working on is actually expanding the data out to. The first paper is looking at Pakistan, so the next paper is expanding it to strikes in Yemen.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. I look forward to that personally.
Yeah, and also looking at effectiveness as well as civilian casualties, because one thing we found is that we really don't want to look at civilian casualties and try to minimize those independently of the overall question of are we being effective, because you can do that very easily. There used to be a joke in Afghanistan. It's very easy to drive civilian casualties to zero. You just don't ever leave the base. So, inaction is one solution for civilian casualties, but it's not necessarily the best solution. So we try to be constructive and say, okay, how can we maintain freedom of action? How can we maintain and even improve effectiveness while also reducing civilian casualties when feasible? So those are the kinds of issues we're going to be exploring in the future.
Well, that is great. I look forward to seeing these papers when they're released, and I'm sure our listeners will be quite excited about that as well. And for our listeners, we will post a link to this paper. So it's Drone Strikes in Pakistan, Reasons to Assess Civilian Casualties. And Dr. Lewis, thank you so much for coming on the show, and giving us your expertise on this very important and very informative topic.
Thanks for having me.
And we will talk to you soon.